I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is the Tech Central Show. TCS is brought to you by MTN Business. Visit mtnbusiness.co.za to learn more, and we thank them for their support of the show to bring you these great interviews. Now, my guest today is Scott Gibson, and I'm sure many viewers of and listeners to the show will remember Scott from his days at Dimension Data. He joined Dimension Data back in 2000 as Vice President of Group Finance and held a number of roles in the group over the years, including heading up its digital practice and also leading the Brighthouse business. Now, Scott left Dimension Data, which of course is now NTT Data, in 2019 and has held various roles since then, most recently as CEO of a company called Pragma Global. Scott, good to see you. Welcome to Tech Central. Thanks for making the time.
Nice to see you, Duncan. And it's been a while as you and I were reminiscing as I came in.
About the Tour de France.
Yeah. I miss that. You know, a lot of people ask me, do you miss your days at Dimension Data? And obviously I do, right, for the various reasons, because there's still a lot of friends and colleagues there. But yeah, I miss those Tour de France days because we had a lot of fun building that solution and building the tech, you know, all the data that people see on the screens now. It started with a very rudimentary solution and has evolved even since I've left, obviously, into a fantastic solution. So I miss those days. Yeah. Definitely. We had a lot of fun doing that.
I presume you got to travel over to France for the event as well.
I did. Yeah. I think I went to 3 Tour de France's. Mm. So yeah, there's a lot of FOMO when I watch the Tour de France now and I see all of that going on. Yeah.
Are you a cyclist too? I remember half of Dimension Data's executive teams.
We all were and I still am and still enjoy it. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Okay. Are you one of these crazies who gets up at 5 in the morning to go cycling?
Not as much as I used to. You know, the roads have got a little bit more dangerous, but... But also technology, funnily enough, has moved on, right? So if you look at how we can, the indoor cycling we can do now and the virtual environments that we have, makes it a lot easier to actually ride with your mates indoors. Who would have thought? But so we do a lot of that now too.
Okay.
It's a bit safer.
Yeah. For sure. So tell me, you left DD back in 2019.
2019, yeah.
What have you been up to since then?
So I took a break. I mean, I had in my last year at Didata, I think I'd spent 100 days away from home and I had young kids. And so I needed to kind of get back to my family a little bit. It had been quite hectic. Obviously, a lot of it was Tour de France related. So in some respects, it might have been a level of guilt there that I was away having fun and leaving my family. So I took a break. I made the conscious decision to take at least 6 months off and do nothing. And actually had some very good counsel from Zoab Husin, who you probably know from Microsoft. You know, he was head of Microsoft at the time.
Yes.
And Zoab actually was the one who gave me some mentorship and said, listen, you've been in a bubble for 20 years. You need to step out, take some time to think about what you want to do and just, you know, make your next decision. And so I did that. And then I invested in a couple of businesses privately and, you know, in my own capacity, all in the digital space, some in the digital sports space, so carrying over my legacy from the Tour de France. And I thought they would keep me busy. I thought private equity investing would keep me busy and keep me mentally challenged. And it did to some extent, but it wasn't enough.
Okay.
My wife then decided to go back to university, and so I was the one stuck at home. It wasn't like we could go traveling around the world. And then I found Pragma. And the opportunity at Pragma. And what really attracted me about Pragma was it felt like Brighthouse. And I really had enjoyed my time at Brighthouse. You know, that for me, if I looked back at my career and said, when was I at my happiest? It was when I was running the Brighthouse business. We were medium size. So you kind of, in the end, we started off at 200 people. And when we sold it back to Dimension Data, I think we were 1,000 people. So I was looking for something like that. And then I found Pragma, and that's sort of why I'm back here. My investments are still running that I've got. One of which is Contactable, which is a digital identity business, and I'm still chairman of that, but doesn't really keep me that busy. They run well on their own. But then I wanted something full-time again, and I wanted a purpose. I'm still young enough to work, so that's why I've ended up at Pragma.
Did you know about Pragma when you were running Brighthouse?
I didn't, actually.
No. Okay.
I didn't, funnily enough. I mean, it's a business that's 30 years old. The founder, Adrian Skiers, started the business with 3 other engineers. And it's very niche, very focused business. And I'm surprised as well that I didn't find it in my sort of private equity investing phase. I had started to have conversations with a couple of the medium to large size private equity buyers in South Africa around what I thought a good investment would look like in the tech space. Mm-hmm. And I'd come up with a couple of criteria. I said that I felt that from my old days when I used to sell SAP, that I think the world has evolved, the SAP or the software world has evolved, and the buyer, the way people buy has changed. In the olden days, you didn't get fired for buying SAP or IBM. You remember that old statement. Mm-hmm. But with the advent of the cloud, and you sort of had these specialization softwares that came out, or niche softwares that came out. Mm-hmm. And my view was that people were now starting to buy business outcomes, not necessarily buy software. Mm. And so when I was looking around at my investment criteria, it was I wanted to invest in businesses that were niche and to a specific vertical or a specific horizontal, cybersecurity being one, for example. The other thing was that a business should own its own IP. So in my opinion, if you're going to be successful, you don't just want to be the reseller of someone else's software. If you really want to be successful as a business, you need to own your own IP. Thirdly, you need it to be globally relevant, right? So something that was only going to sell into the South African market, in my opinion, wasn't an attractive investment criteria. And then fourthly, agile, somebody who was thinking using modern technologies to build software and roll it out around the world. And so funnily enough, when I came across Pragma, I actually saw an advert for the job on LinkedIn.
Okay.
And I didn't know the company at the time, but I looked at the role and I thought, oh, this looks interesting. Mm-hmm. And I applied. And then as I got to understand the business a little bit more, I was like, hang on, this business ticks all of my criteria. And so that's why I ended up where I am. And obviously I wasn't the only person that applied. So I had to go through a bit of a process with the board. But I think at the end of the day, I think the board liked my background, given where Pragma's trying to go. Mm. And yeah, they hired me. So here I am. Okay. Back at work again.
So tell me a bit about Pragma. What does it do exactly?
So to my earlier point about it being very niche, so it's focused on customers that are – we service customers that have asset-intensive investments. So the mines, the big manufacturing businesses, all the downstream oil and gas downstream providers like Shell, Sasol, Astron that have, forecourts and mm-hmm. investments that are – really, really critical to their success. We focus on helping them understand the maintenance plans and processes for their assets. So how do you keep your asset in good condition? How do you extend the life of an asset? How do you make sure it's operating as efficiently as possible? How do you predict potential maintenance issues? How do you stop non-predicted maintenance issues? And so we consult. We've got engineers in our business that are really good at understanding the maturity of your maintenance plans and how you extend the life of your assets and ensure they operate in those conditions that I've just described. You can outsource to us, so we can place reliability engineers in your business if you want and manage the processes for you. And then we have a piece of software called OnKey, which competes with the likes of SAP's plant maintenance module. It competes with IBM's Maximo. Mm-hmm. And so that's to my earlier point, that's that IP that this business really has. And that's been around. So the business has been around for 30 years. There's about 450 people in the organization now, largely engineers, and I'm not an engineer.
Mostly here in South Africa?
Mostly here in South Africa, although we've got a small office in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And we have a partner business in Texas and Mexico, who are really doing well as well. So they basically a franchise operation of ours. So, and I think they've got about 50 people in their business. So we've started to see some real interest in our offering globally, primarily our software, because as you know, software exports a lot easier.
Yeah.
But we niche. We stay in our lane. It's all around assets. And that's to my earlier point. I feel that when customers buy from us, they're buying a business outcome. And it's all around how do you turn maintenance from being a cost center to being a business enabler.
Are there particular industries that you focus on?
So, yeah, I guess any industry that's asset intensive, right? So we've had a lot of success in the mining sector. We've had a lot of success in the manufacturing environment. So we've got some bakeries as clients of ours. And then to my earlier point, we look after 1,700 forecourts around the country right now, all made up with Astron, Shell and Sasol's forecourts, both commercial and retail. And then I guess we also now started to move a lot into the property space with some, and we've recently won a deal in the healthcare sector. So we're now going to be looking after the assets of a private hospital.
Okay.
Because you can imagine they don't want the X-ray machine to break down.
Yeah.
They don't want incubators to break down. So we're seeing a lot of interest in a number of sectors. But I'd say that, manufacturing, mining, and oil and gas has probably been our primary sectors in the past.
And mainly consulting type services? What's the revenue mix in the business?
Yeah, so half of our revenue comes from the outsourced business. So, a lot of our, to that extent, for example, the oil and gas guys, we take over the entire maintenance process of their assets. So we have contractors that will come and do the repairs of the pumps and the tanks at a fuel station. We also look after the HVAC and refrigeration inside the shop. And then there's building maintenance. So we've got teams that identify where there are these requirements, and then we make sure that our contractors, the right contractor comes along, he's got the right equipment to do the fix at the right price in the right time frame, so that ultimately our clients don't have to worry about it. So that's our outsource business. And then the other 25% comes from our software, which is the fastest growing part of our business. So I'd imagine in a few years' time, hopefully I'll be telling you that our software makes up more than 50% of our revenue. And then the other 25% is advisory, pure advisory consulting.
Right.
What we do.
Okay. Yeah. And I believe you've been tasked by the board to grow the business internationally. Just tell us about your plans in that regard and what you see the opportunity as being.
Yeah, so as I said, we've already got some nice, interesting clients in Europe. So Tetra Pak is our biggest client in Europe. So the nice thing is that we've proven that we can deliver that model offshore. I believe that we need to export the software.
Mm-hmm.
I think to try and export our consulting and outsource is going to be more difficult, but I'm not saying we're not going to do it. We'll look at it on a case-by-case basis. So we've got a few plans for Europe, but Europe, as you know, is made up of, 50 countries now, maybe even more.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to pick a couple that we think where we can be successful. So we've already been successful in the Netherlands and Switzerland and Sweden, so we'll probably kind of remain in those territories. And then in the US, where our partner there has seen a lot of success in – specifically in Texas, actually. I can imagine Texas, probably the economy, the size of Texas is probably quite significant
bigger than South Africa.
Probably
sure.
bigger than South Africa. So we're going to do that. And then we've had some success with a property company in Malaysia. So a lot of the times we're also following our clients.
Okay.
And that was also the old Didata model too, right? We would follow wherever our clients were, because they already understand us, they know what our product capabilities are, and that's the plan. And then we might make some acquisitions along the way. So hopefully we find something interesting that complements our current offering, and then we'll do that.
Okay. So I was going to ask whether these expansion plans would necessitate the need for a capital raise of some kind. Is that in the planning, or does your balance sheet allow you to do what you want to do?
No, our balance sheet's good. I mean, it's not. If we go and make something really significant, we probably would have to consider some sort of capital raise in some shape or form. But we've been able to make all of our global expansions at the moment off our own balance sheet, which has been great. Because at the end of the day, we can actually service a lot of our clients from here. You know, we don't have to go and set up whole, and that's the beauty of the cloud and having your software in the cloud. We don't have to go and set up a whole implementation team and hire a whole implementation team and base them out of Europe. And we're not an asset intensive business, for luckily, so we don't have to invest in a lot of capital. It's mainly people.
Yes.
Yeah, so we can kind of incrementally grow those teams as and when the opportunities arise.
And it's a Joburg-based business, is it?
So this is an interesting debate. If my staff or the team are watching this, there's a story going on that head office is in Cape Town, but we're now calling Cape Town the regional office because I'm based in Joburg. So
okay.
Our head office is Cape Town. So the founders came from that part of the world. They were all Stellenbosch University individuals. So our head office is actually in Bellville.
Okay.
But we have half of our team are probably Joburg based because a lot of our clients are still, you know, based up here in this part of the country.
Yeah. So. There's been a lot of movement to Cape Town, particularly amongst IT folk. Do you see Cape Town becoming more of an IT center going forward?
Definitely.
I mean, historically, a lot of the big corporates have been based here in Joburg. Do you think that means that system integrators and that sort of IT enterprise will necessarily have to be based here in Joburg, or do you think increasingly we're going to see companies relocating?
There's no doubt that if I look at our software business and the people that we employ in there, so they are software developers, right, that are building out our on-key software. There's no doubt that Cape Town is the tech hub, but that also comes with its challenges. If you look at the likes of, I mean, the war on talent now for those people, I mean, you've now got Amazon down there, you've got Garmin, I believe, are creating some sort of office down there. So all of a sudden now, you know, we've got this war on talent for software developers, and yes, you're right. I think Cape Town is the hub, but hopefully we'll try and align with where our customers are, so that we're, you know, readily available if they need us. But when it comes to the software side of our business, we can deliver from anywhere. Who knows? We might have a team in the Ukraine soon. You know, you know, we're talking about Ronnie's business and how you set it up there. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So, what are some of the big trends you're seeing in the software market at the moment, enterprise software market at the moment, that's got you excited? Everyone's talking about generative AI and how that's going to change the world. Are you guys also looking at that?
Yeah, we have to. I mean, if we want to stay relevant in our specific niche that we're in, we have to. So using, you know, you're talking about AI, the world of asset maintenance, which might, you know, it might sound like a very boring sector, has to figure out how to stay relevant in the world. So I'll come back to AI, but you know, at the front end, we've had to figure out how to make it a mobile first world. So how, when it comes to maintenance, you don't want a maintenance engineer now running around with a piece of paper, taking note of all the maintenance or production issues in the plant. So we've had to make sure that our software can receive data through mobile devices. The next area in our space is this area of digital twins. And, you know, your ability to effectively scenario plan maintenance or shutdowns through the digital twin version of whatever the asset is out there. A very interesting area to go and look at is there's a business in the UK called Hill Helicopters, and I have an aeronautical interest in helicopters. And this guy has literally built a helicopter digitally, and now he's doing it physically as well. And so all of the scenario planning that he's done on a digital version to test to what extent are things going to break. And follow, if you're interested in that space, he's quite an interesting character, Jason Hill, and I think he's going to deliver the ultimate solution, hopefully soon. I went off on a tangent.
No, not at all.
The other area is AI, to your point. I mean, we need to trust, you know, use machine learning and then into AI to trust when it tells us, you know, at what point do we have to schedule predictive maintenance or allow AI to tell us and make data-driven decisions? Mm. And so we're seeing a lot of that in our space. The other trend, I guess, is around the fact that I think, to my earlier point, around ERPs and software, we're seeing people adopt hybrid ERPs, right? So what does that mean? It's, I guess, APIs have got, you know, we live in this new API world where everybody's happy to integrate into the best of breed solutions that are out there. So we're seeing this trend where there's less of a reliance on an end-to-end ERP, and people are open to the idea of creating this hybrid ERP. So here you could have, you know, SAP or Office 365, but then you inject specific modules from the best of breed suppliers out there, whether it's Salesforce from a CRM perspective or us.
The industry seems to go through waves on this. One moment it's, you know, one vendor for everything because that will make us more efficient, and then the next moment it's best of breed from whichever vendor does the best solution. Yep. The industry seems to go in sort of cycles like this, doesn't it?
Yeah, you're right. And who knows, maybe in a few years' time, they'll all have acquired, like the big boys will all have acquired all these specialist vendors, right? Exactly. And, you know, that's what they end up doing. Remember, yes, when SAP bought SuccessFactors, now all of a sudden, you know, they brought in the best of breed HR system. So that's probably what creates the waves.
Right.
the big ERP players just go and buy out everybody. That's one of the trends that I think we're seeing as well.
Okay. What do you see as the future for Pragma? Do you see Pragma being consolidated in one of these waves, or do you see yourself staying independent?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess we haven't set out to go and get bought by anyone. So it's certainly not our mission. I think we feel that we still have an opportunity to have our time in the sun. I think the vision is that we want to be recognized as a brand that has been able to punch above its weight. You know, we, as a South African business, I think growing globally, we are competing against the big players, you know, the SAPs of the world. And I'd like to think that a lot of our clients will then choose us and go, hang on, I'm glad I'd made that decision, right? I mean, they were very focused on what I was trying to achieve in that specific box. They've delivered, they've over-delivered against what they promised me. And I think that's what I'd want us to be known for. Mm. Having lived that world, you know, Dimension Data, I guess we did. We started like that, right? We started as this South African business that made a couple of strategic international acquisitions. And over time, we were the brand that was running the Tour de France, you know, kind of thing. But so I'd hope that Pragma can follow, not at the same scale as Dimension Data. We're not at that. We don't have those expectations. But kind of follow that trajectory and say, listen, you know, these guys are good. Mm-hmm. And they come from South Africa, and they're really delivering against what I'm trying to achieve. So that's our goal. And we want to grow. Don't get me wrong. We want to grow our top line and our bottom line because we've got shareholders who want to make a return.
Yeah, yeah. And where does the name come from? Is it short for pragmatic?
Yeah, I don't know, actually. Oh. That's a very good question. I'll need to go and research that. Adrian never told me that. So Adrian, who's the founder and who effectively employed me because of his retirement, I don't think I ever asked him that question. I'm sure it must have something to do with that.
Pragmatism.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, fascinating. Scott, good luck with the new job and the new role. Look forward to seeing how Pragma develops under your watch. Scott Gibson is CEO of Pragma Global. Thank you for sharing your insights with our audience today. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Duncan. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks.